KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Schools that receive federal money face an ultimatum from the Department of Education and diversity programs or face cuts in funding. We'll look at the impacts in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Stock prices are very high, which seems like good news. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin, but some analysts warn the market may be overvalued. We asked David Wessel of the Brookings Institution what's going on. Also, could China take advantage of the Trump administration's efforts to shrink the federal government? And we hear from the author of Dream State, a new novel that looks at the friendship between men. It's Wednesday, February 19th. Happy birthday to the woman who brought us H-O-T-T-O-G-O. Senior Chapel Roan turns 27 today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal judge is declining to temporarily halt the work of President Trump's Doge entity. It's overseen by billionaire Elon Musk. More than a dozen Democratic state attorneys general had sued to try to block Musk's team from accessing government systems and laying off federal employees. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the judge did raise concerns about the legality of Musk's work in the White House.
14 states sued to prevent Doge from accessing government data and participating in laying off thousands of government workers. The states argued that only an official who was nominated by President Trump and confirmed by the Senate can have that much power. Judge Tanya Chutkan in Washington notes that Musk's actions appear to be precisely the executive abuses the Constitution intended to prevent, but she would not issue a temporary restraining order, saying the state's request lacked evidence. While Musk is the public face of Doge, the White House now says in court papers that Elon Musk is not its leader. Trump officials have now publicly stated who is running Doge. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is asking the U.S. to stop using Kremlin disinformation when talking about Russia's war on Ukraine. Yesterday, President Trump blamed Ukraine for starting the war with Russia. That is not true. Russia launched a full-scale surprise invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports this comes as Trump's special envoy on Russia and Ukraine arrived in Kyiv today.
Zelensky looked grim and exhausted as he briefed reporters in Kyiv about the challenges facing Ukraine a day after the U.S. and Russia appeared to take the first steps toward normalizing ties. After Trump recently said, "You shouldn't have started the war," a Kremlin talking point, Zelensky said Trump appeared to be living in a zone of disinformation. I would like to see more truth out of the Trump team, Zelensky said, because this affects Ukraine and not in a positive way. He said he hopes to make his case to Trump's special envoy to Ukraine and Russia, Keith Kellogg, who is in Kyiv for talks. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News.
Brazil's attorney general has indicted the country's former right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro. NPR's Kerry Khan says prosecutors accused Bolsonaro of plotting a coup in 2022 to stay in power.
They're stunning charges. The standout points, prosecutors say that Bolsonaro and 33 others, or they said it was this vast criminal organization to keep him in power after he narrowly lost to the current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. On top of that, there was also this plot outlined to poison Lula, kill his vice president and a Supreme Court justice who Bolsonaro has feuded with.
NPR's Kerry Khan reporting. Bolsonaro has denied the allegations. He says they're fanciful and won't prevail in court. This is NPR. President Trump says he plans to impose fresh tariffs on imported automobiles, semiconductor chips, and on pharmaceuticals. He says these tariffs could be worth up to 25% or higher, and they could start in April. Reuters news agency says nearly half of all generic prescriptions filled in the U.S. during 2022 were imported. The head of the U.S. Postal Service says he is going to step down. Louis DeJoy has served as Postmaster General for nearly 5 years. He has asked the Postal Service Board of Governors to begin seeking his successor. In Portugal, surfers have again faced the giant waves of Nazaré, about 70 miles north of Lisbon. NPR's Miguel Macias reports they're in Tudor Nazaré's Big Wave Challenge.
Playa do Norte Beach in Nazaré is not just another big wave site. It actually holds the record for the biggest wave ever surfed, over 90 feet tall, and the next three spots in that ranking. On Tuesday, Frances Justine Dupont won the women's competition in her return to the yearly Nazaré Challenge. And that's no small feat for the 33-year-old champion who took the stage holding her one-year-old child and thanked her team.
You can say we should have a prize for the best driver in Nazaré for all time. It's Eric. He's the best driver for all the time.
And that's because catching such a big wave is too dangerous to attempt on your own. Surfers like Dupont are propelled by a teammate driving a jet ski, who placed them in the sweet spot to be able to ride these giants. Miguel Macias, NPR News.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The Department of Education has given all schools, from preschools to colleges, that receive federal funding an ultimatum. Scrap their diversity programs by the end of the month or face funding cuts. School administrators were told that treating students differently on the basis of race violates a Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action and is, quote, unlawful. The deadline was laid out in a letter from the Department of Education's Civil Rights Office that called systemic and structural racism, quote, a false premise. To talk about this, we're joined by Cynthia Jackson Hammond. She's president of the Council for Higher Education Accreditation. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here, Cynthia. When you read this letter from the Department of Education, what was your initial reaction?
I thought the letter was very overreaching. I thought it was threatening, and it certainly does demean the principles of institutional autonomy in higher education. It is very vague, and we must remember that it is guidance and not the law.
Well, what are you hearing from college administrators about what they're going to do? I mean, their funding is at risk.
The first thing is that it's a two-week span that they have to do a real assessment as to whether or not any of their programs fit the vagueness of this letter. I think that they will, some institutions will seek legal recourse, and some will begin to do a deep dive to examine if any of their programs are violating the law.
But do they know how to comply? You mentioned the vagueness. I mean, will this impact what school libraries can carry? Will it change what schools can teach? I mean, I'm thinking about African American history, for example. Do administrators have an understanding of how to comply?
I don't think that they have a full understanding, and that is the problem with this dear colleague letter. Institutions are there to support their students regardless of what the race, culture, or ethnicity. So there's a fine line between removing programs that are considered to be discriminatory by race and removing programs that speak to a cultural or ethnicity support for students. So this is not going to be a quick and easy kind of examination.
The letter from the DOE says that right now schools and colleges are treating students differently on the basis of race, and it claims that race-based programs have hurt white and Asian students in particular. Is this an accurate description of what diversity, equity, and inclusion programs do at schools and colleges?
No, it's not. These are subjective inaccuracies. There's nothing in the guidelines of institutions that said that only these students or only one particular group of students will benefit from this, from a program. So it's the assertion from this letter that these inaccuracies exist.
Is structural and systemic racism that minority communities face in the United States, particularly Black Americans, a false premise, as this letter states?
If the premises were false, then there would be no need to have these kind of support systems for all students. So we have to go back and look historically at what America has done to keep students of a certain race, a certain culture, from the educational experience. If it were never identified as such, then the need for diversity, equity, and inclusion would not have been needed.
Describe to me some of the diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, what they do, and what their goal is. So if they're not around, what happens?
Well, I think too often we focus just on diversity. And the second part of diversity, equity, and inclusion is equity, which means fairness. How do you present policies, practices, and procedures that are fair to everyone, including faculty, staff, and students? For instance, being able to have programs that support women in leadership or women just in the work environment, that's fairness. Prior to the constructs of DEI, there was very little alternative or options for women to have a fair and equal chance to succeed in the communities or in higher education in general.
And if colleges and schools lose this funding, what happens?
If they lose their funding, I hope that colleges and institutions do not lose their integrity, their principles, and their values just to appease funding. I think that there would be community support to allow them to do the programs that represent the values of that institution.
That's Cynthia Jackson Hammond, President of the Council for Education Accreditation. Thank you, Cynthia, for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
President Trump's drive to cut back the federal government includes cuts to a traditional tool against China.
Yeah, the United States has promoted democracy and human rights abroad, and it's been seen as a way to counter the influence of authoritarian countries, especially China. Now, the U.S. is blocking those efforts as part of an effort led by Elon Musk, the presidential aide who is the world's richest man.
NPR's Emily Fang has covered China for many years and is on the line. Emily, good morning.
Hey, Steve, good morning.
Okay, so why would the administration back off democracy promotion now?
Well, part of the reason given by Musk and other people close to Trump is that the agencies that fund these groups you're talking about are wasteful. Musk has accused specifically the aid agency USAID of being behind a, quote, hoax about Russian influence in the Trump administration without giving evidence. The U.S. has also paused human rights and civil society-related grants to the State Department. And the latest funding freeze I've been tracking is at the National Endowment for Democracy, or NED. Interesting, some Republicans, like Marco Rubio, who is now U.S. Secretary of State, had previously seen groups they funded as essential to U.S. national security because they build soft power by promoting U.S. democratic ideals abroad. But since Rubio's joined the Trump administration, he's defended these massive cuts.
Okay, so this is worldwide, the effects of these changes. But a good portion of the funding was supporting Chinese dissidents, some diversity of opinion within China. So what does China think of that?
They have not said much publicly, but this is a huge windfall for China because these are all organizations Beijing found a nuisance. And I found signs that China is trying to co-opt some of these groups now. At least two human rights organizations that are China-focused but based here in the U.S. tell me they've actually been approached by people within the Chinese government offering to introduce them to new China-based funders. And this has specifically happened in just the last few days since they've faced losing funding from the U.S. I also talked directly with a Chinese state representative who answers to the government there, who requested anonymity because they're not authorized to speak publicly. They reached out to at least one China-focused civil society group that is at risk of losing their funding and proposed to them. Instead of criticizing people and organizations in China publicly, perhaps they could facilitate private conversations with China to achieve social change. And one of the groups he was in contact with said, you know, this feels like a tactic to buy their silence, though the Chinese state representative argued to me it would be a more effective way for organizations to work.
Wow, thanks for all that reporting. So what are some of these groups that risk getting their funding cut?
They're the exact kind of the groups that China and other authoritarian governments criticize. These are women's rights groups, human rights research groups, legal aid nonprofits. One of them is New York-based China Labor Watch. It was started by a researcher named Li Qiang, and his group investigates labor rights abuses. He says here he's chosen to go on the record with me because he left China when he felt he could not speak freely there. So he says now, if he stays silent on the funding cuts, what was the point of coming to the U.S.?
Well, how does this affect Americans?
Well, for better or worse, the U.S. is competing with China on social influence and soft power. And some human rights workers say they're worried about this convergence between how Trump administration officials talk about democracy and how governments like China describe it. Francisco Bencosme is USAID's former China policy lead.
The geopolitical information warfare is no longer something that's happening halfway across the world, but is happening within our own governments.
For example, Musk called NED a scam and then cited a story on X, a takedown of the U.S. Foundation from the Foreign Ministry of China.
Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's Emily Fang.
European leaders are meeting for a second emergency summit in Paris today to debate how to monitor a potential ceasefire agreement between Ukraine and Russia. This comes a day after top officials from the U.S. and Russia held talks over ending the war without Europeans at the table. From Brussels, Terry Schultz takes a look at what Europe's mission may entail.
Even with no conditions yet set for Russia and Ukraine, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth issued tough terms to European NATO allies last week, assigning them to be the keepers of the peace Washington intends to broker.
To be clear, there will not be U.S. troops deployed to Ukraine.
Hegseth said this mission cannot be under NATO auspices, nor benefit from the alliance's guarantees of support in case Russia attacks. So, can European militaries go it alone?
The mindset that the Europeans should have is a yes-we-can mindset.
That's former NATO official Camille Grand, now with the European Council on Foreign Relations.
We can do it, but there are some political and military conditions that have to be met. I could foresee a situation where the force is made of European boots on the ground, but does benefit from forms of support provided by NATO and the United States for the command and control, for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities.
These are conditions allies are urging the Trump administration to accept. The Carnegie Endowment's Michael Kaufman has just returned from near the front line in Ukraine. He envisions a limited ground force.
Something on the equivalent of three brigades, maybe about 15,000 troops. They need about three times that, perhaps, for rotation. So a total of 40 to 50,000 personnel. This is rather achievable in the means of current European militaries.
They would reinforce, not replace, Ukrainian troops, Kaufman says, and wouldn't have to cover the whole front line if Moscow respects whatever boundaries are eventually established. But counting on Kremlin compliance could still be politically paralyzing for European leaders, with lives of their soldiers at stake. As Kaufman describes, one all-important question.
If it is a tripwire force, then what does that tripwire connect to?
If the answer is anything less than the Pentagon, Europeans fear their presence alone won't be convincing to the Kremlin. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, Germany's federal elections are on Sunday, and Elon Musk is supporting the far-right candidate for chancellor. As the Trump administration moves America's foreign policy to the right, European leaders are concerned about the future of their alliance with the U.S. We'll talk with Anne Applebaum, who writes about the new authoritarianism. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. How much can a friendship endure? The novelist Eric Puchner explores that question in his book Dream State. Oprah just chose it as her latest book club read, but never mind that, because Andrew Limbong also chose it. He's host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast, and he gave it a read.
Dream State opens with a wedding, with all the stresses and worries a wedding brings. The weather might turn, the photographer might be late, you know, the rings could get lost. But for bride and groom Cece and Charlie, the Eden, that is, their lakeside wedding in Montana, gets ruined by something more gastrointestinal. Here's author Eric Puchner reading.
Norovirus had felled a third of the groom's party. They sheltered inside, too ill to come out. The place was like an isolation ward. Guests lay on the floor with buckets or slept curled around the toilet between attacks. You could hear groaning through the windows, unspeakable sounds.
Puchner said the scene was unfortunately inspired by true life.
I was asked to officiate a wedding, and I think maybe I won't say who it was, in Montana. And
the groom's father got norovirus and spread it to the other guests.
It was actually worse than it is in the book. One of the flower children threw up on the way down the aisle. And also, much like Charlie in the book, the groom was so sick he had to sit down during the wedding vows. I mean, he was green with illness. And I should say they're very happily married now and have five children. So it works out.
But you cannot say the same thing for Cece and Charlie in the novel, because Cece, the love of Charlie's life, ends up marrying Charlie's best friend, Garrett. It's a classic love triangle, one that Puchner uses to examine the big themes of the book.
This love triangle between these three characters, the mistakes that they make in the past, both the sort of private mistakes that they make, but also the kind of public generational mistakes that they make, have repercussions not only for themselves, but for their children and the next generation. And so the way that story paralleled the story of climate change and it's what's happening to the American West felt serendipitous to me.
Like a dad with norovirus ruining his children's wedding.
Exactly.
The novel moves back and forth through time, touching on the marriages and careers and kids that come out of this trio, how they react to a changing world, but also on the foundation on which the friendship is built. In one pivotal scene, Garrett and Charlie are back in college, walking home from a Halloween party. They're dunking on each other the way guys love to do until Garrett accidentally makes an anti-Semitic joke. Charlie blows up, and neither of them quite know where to go from there. Here's Puchner reading.
They were 19-year-old men. They were dressed like ducks. Male friendship was all about rhythm. It was a kind of song without words, an instrumental you knew by heart. You learned the rhythm together and practiced it all the time, for days and months and years, perfecting it by feel. It was the swing of your silences, the karaoke track behind the gibberish you sang. The rhythm itself said the important things, the non-jokey things, so you wouldn't have to. Still, there are times like this, rare ones, when it wasn't enough.
Words such as, hey man, I'm sorry, or I love you, run the risk of ruining this rhythm, when you're 19 at least. But Puchner wanted to write about how these friendships can change over time.
You know, I was just actually with a bunch of friends last week, and it was remarkable to me how much of it still revolved around that sort of like jokey insult stuff. We play euchre, and we drink beer and we kind of insult each other. But the difference now is that there's also direct expressions of warmth and gratitude and affection.
Buchner says he hasn't seen a lot of literary fiction that focused on male friendship, something his wife, the novelist Catherine Noel, agreed with.
I do think that friendship is underrepresented in fiction, and that truly great works about friendship, things like Ferrante's Neapolitan novels, are often about women's friendships.
I wanted to talk to Noel because the book is set in Montana, inspired by where Noel's great-grandfather built a house, where she went a lot as a kid, and where the family still head to every summer. And as the novel moves through time, the air in Montana is a little dirtier, the lake a little drier.
Yes, of course. Like, Glacier Park looks different than it did when I was a child. Flathead Lake is different than it was when I was a child. So yes, those things feel sad and difficult, but they also are manifestations of something that is sad and difficult all the time. Hmm. It's not like I'm only thinking about the environment when I'm in Montana, but Montana is a place where it feels very concrete.
This is not a spoiler, but by the end of Dream State, you get the sense that your relationships, your home, your world will not and cannot look the same in 5, 10, 50 years. That's obvious, of course, but the question the book raises is it worth trying to hold on to those things anyway? Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
In the music industry, there's a phenomenon called the Grammy bump. An artist wins a Grammy Award and suddenly sees a short-lived but significant spike in listening and sales. So is there a Super Bowl bump? Stephen Thompson of NPR Music has the answer.
Musicians who perform at the Super Bowl halftime show aren't paid a premium to do so. Instead, the NFL pays performers union scale, a fraction of what a big-name artist would normally receive for a performance. But there are huge incentives to performing in front of the gargantuan audience that watches the Super Bowl on TV. And for proof, you need only look at this week's Billboard charts. Kendrick Lamar, this year's halftime headliner, now has three entries in the top 10 of this week's album chart, including his latest, GNX, which is back at number one. I walk in, walk out with the size. Man, don't let me know what the pass. Squabble up. GNX's return to the top was fueled by more than just the Super Bowl. 2 days before his performance, the rapper finally released the album on vinyl and CD for the first time. Before that, it was just available to stream and download. Lamar also claims the number one, number two, and number three spots on the songs chart, led by Not Like Us, which returns to number one a full 29 weeks after it last held that spot. They not like us. They not like us. They not like us. Kendrick's collaborator on the Super Bowl stage got a boost from the performance as well. SZA is sitting right behind Kendrick on the album chart at number two with her record SOS. As the first hip-hop artist ever to land three top 10 albums in the same week, Kendrick Lamar has scored some bragging rights to help make his Super Bowl weekend even more worthwhile. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music. If it was up to me,
this is NPR News.
Ireland may soon pass a bill banning trade with Israeli settlements in the occupied territories.
And in practice, what that would mean is that if you're a supermarket here and you're stocking dates that have been produced in illegal settlements, you'll be asked to pull them from your shelves.
I'm Scott Detrow. How war in the Middle East reverberates in unlikely places. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is pushing back against President Trump's false rhetoric blaming the war in Eastern Europe on Ukraine instead of Russia. Under Trump, U.S. policy toward Russia has warmed in recent days. The president says the war in Ukraine has to end. Today, Special Envoy Keith Kellogg's in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv.
We have some wonderful talks with President Zelensky and his staff and his military commanders. You know, it's kind of nice that I'm here just a few days before the third anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
In New York, a federal judge is slated to hold a hearing today on the Justice Department's move to drop corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. The Democrats under growing pressure to resign. Queensborough President Donovan Richards Jr. reacted to news that four of Adams' top aides had planned to step down.
These deputy mayors, many who I know, certainly bring a breath of knowledge to this business and to our city, and we need to see them replaced immediately.
Adams denies the DOJ dropped its case against him in exchange for his cooperation with the Trump administration's immigration enforcement in his city. Seven experienced prosecutors resigned last week in protest after the DOJ moved to suspend charges against Adams. U.S. stocks trading lower this hour. The Dow is down 130 points. This is NPR. About 90 whales stranded on a remote beach in southern Australia will be euthanized after attempts to return them to the sea failed. Christina Kukulia reports wildlife experts believe the pod has been stranded for as long as 2 days.
The surviving animals were among more than 150 killer whales to be discovered on an isolated beach on the island state of Tasmania on Tuesday. Today, wildlife experts said efforts to refloat them have been unsuccessful. They say the location of the beach, together with weather and ocean conditions, had made rescue work more difficult. The whales are said to be in distress, with authorities confirming they would be euthanized. Mass strandings of whales are not uncommon in Tasmania, but this is the first involving false killer whales in over 50 years. For NPR News, I'm Christina Kukulia in Melbourne, Australia.
The Vatican's update on Pope Francis today is encouraging. A day after the public learned the 88-year-old pontiff has pneumonia, a spokesman says the Pope's heart is in good condition. Francis's weekly general audience was canceled, but pilgrims are still arriving at the Vatican. Some are on Holy Year pilgrimages. The Dow is down 119 points, the S&P has fallen 1, and the NASDAQ is down 23 points. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. I don't mean to shock you, but I read a lot of newspapers, specifically newspaper apps, which I find a lot more informative than scrolling social media. One of the papers I follow is the Wall Street Journal, which has had compelling reports on the new administration and also recently had a headline about the stock market. The Journal talked of, quote, froth in the market. And the article worked through the evidence that the stock market, which is very high right now, is overvalued, and so it could be heading for a drop. David Wessel is director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution and is here for an assessment. David, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
I guess we should note you used to work for the Wall Street Journal. So what's the argument behind warnings that the market might be overvalued right now?
Well, let's be clear from the start, Steve. I don't know what the market's going to do. And if everybody thought the market was going to go down, stock prices would have already fallen. But those people, including my former colleagues at the Journal, point out that measures that compare stock prices to projected corporate profits, the most famous one is crafted by Nobel laureate Robert Shiller of Yale, are well above the historical average. In fact, they're higher than any time since the internet bubble burst in the early 2000s. Mm. Secondly, until recently, and this changed recently, the stock market's rise was driven by a handful of tech stocks like NVIDIA, the chips maker, and the rest of the market wasn't doing as well. Third, you have an alternative now. 3 years ago, if you bought a 10-year treasury bond, you only got 2% interest. Today, if you buy one, you get 4.5%. So some people think the risk of the stock market not worth it because you can get 4.5% guaranteed by the federal government. And finally, there's a lot of uncertainty, largely driven by President Trump. What's he going to do on tariffs? Is he going to destroy the norms that have governed government? Is he going to lay off a lot of workers? There's an economic uncertainty index that a couple of academic economists keep track of using news reports and other things, and it has soared since the election. So you put all of those things together and people say, it's more likely to go down than go up.
Okay, so interesting. Political instability, an alternative place to put your money, and the prices are getting way above the corporate earnings, the underlying earnings of the stocks. Are particular companies then driving the market and keeping it up?
Well, that was true. There was this group called the Magnificent Seven, including some tech stocks, and they were responsible for a lot of the market's rise last year. But so far this year, other stocks have been going up as well.
I suppose that that is true, although the Journal pointed out that some of these seem to be based on nothing, meme stocks and Bitcoin and that sort of thing. But with all of that said, what is the case that bulls are making, meaning that people who think that the market's going up?
Well, Steve, I'm going to see your Wall Street Journal headline and raise you another.
Okay.
In December last year, not that long ago, the Wall Street Journal had a headline that says, "History shows no link between nosebleed valuations like today's and next year's returns. Expensive stocks can always get pricier." So the point is that history doesn't always give you the right answer. Secondly, profits have been really surprisingly strong lately. Third, there's this possibility that artificial intelligence is really going to give a big boost to productivity, which will allow us to be richer and companies to make more money. And finally, some people think the Trump factor will be a plus for the stock market, lower taxes, less regulation, and that will offset the economic damage done by tariffs.
Okay, you've already given us a warning about history not being a prediction of past performance is no guarantee of future results. But what does history say that might be informative here?
Well, I like to tell you a story. Back in 1999, Kevin Hassett, who's now head of President Trump's National Economic Council, published a book called Dow 36,000, very upbeat about the stock market at that time. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was about 10,000.
Yeah.
Then came the bursting of the dot-com bubble, 9/11, global financial crisis. It rose, it fell. Well, he was right. The stock market did finally hit 36,000 on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, but not until November 2023, 24 years after the book came out.
So if you just wait long enough, your prediction will come true. That's the
absolutely
lesson of the story. I predict that David Wessel will be back with us again sometime. David, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
He's with Brookings.
Winter weather in Kentucky is complicating rescue and recovery efforts from weekend floods. 14 people died and more than 1,000 were displaced. Some of them are housed in shelters at skate parks. Karen Czar with member station WUKY visited one shelter that's now cut off by high water.
As I traveled across central and eastern Kentucky, this was the repeated message from my GPS.
Your route may be affected by Kentucky floods.
Along the way, there were remnants of the storm, mud-caked buildings and parking lots, swollen rivers and ponds where roads should be. I finally reached Jenny Wiley State Park in the Appalachian Mountains. It's 10:30 at night. The park has a lodge that's been turned into a shelter, but to get there, you have to take a boat. That's because the road to the lodge has become a lake. the tip of a stop sign pokes out of the water as we pass.
You know, they had FEMA, Red Cross, the RH. It was all weird.
Marty Simpson is steering the pontoon boat. He says relief agencies have been on site to help the more than 140 people sheltering here. Nearly a third of them are children. Simpson has been ferrying many of the displaced residents to their cars and back. He drops me off where the road picks up.
Thank you so much for the ride.
Up at the Jenny Wiley Lodge, the night staff looks exhausted. There's a crackling fire and a doorway decorated with pink and red hearts. It's left over from Valentine's, the day before the rain began to fall. Chad Ratliff holds a bag of snacks. He's from the nearby town of Coal Run. He and his family got an emergency text to evacuate in the middle of the night on Saturday as water surrounded their home.
It's close to midnight when they're saying, hey, you got to get out or we can't come help you.
He talked with his wife about where to go, and she saw the state park option on Facebook.
So all the hotels in Pikeville were full, and she had heard Jenny Wiley had some rooms. It was first come, first serve, so we headed this direction, and probably if we'd waited a little while, might not even been able to get here.
Ratliff said he's overwhelmed by the scope of this disaster.
All of my neighbors around me and everywhere and the whole shopping centers, it's just devastation.
And the devastation doesn't stop there. People in all of Kentucky's 120 counties have been affected. Ratliff, his eyes set, forces a smile and heads to his room for the night. For NPR News, I'm Karen Czar at Jenny Wiley State Park in Prestonsburg, Kentucky.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration is trying to shut down the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Former employee is sounding the alarm. Next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldil. Guinness World Records said this week the owner of the largest brick collection is an 87-year-old retired engineer in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Clemmering Mayer has 8,882 bricks. He keeps them organized in a dedicated barn. The oldest is a Roman brick from 100 AD. Ones with spelling mistakes are worth more, he told Guinness, like the brick that says Tulsa but with a backwards S. Definitely not another brick in the wall. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Some of President Trump's most ardent supporters in Congress want to revive federal payments to people sickened by atomic weapons testing decades ago. From our member station KNAU, Ryan Heinches has more.
On a windswept desert hillside overlooking Kingman, Arizona, Colin Patillo looks northwest. It's only about 120 miles as the crow flies to the Nevada test site near Las Vegas.
This is essentially what you'd have been looking at in the 1940s or 1950s.
About 100 above-ground nuclear detonations happened at the test site in the 1950s and 60s. Locals could see them from here or catch glimpses of the atomic glow in the pre-dawn hours.
On several occasions, my father and his peers all had stories of watching a bomb blast.
Patillo's family moved to the area in the late 19th century. But in the decades after the tests, his father and his aunt died of cancer. Jean Bishop's family moved here when she was a child. She and all six of her siblings have had cancer too.
We believe it's because of the radiation that floated over the mountains into this area from the nuclear test site in Nevada.
In 1990, Congress authorized compensation payments for those sickened by the atomic bomb testing and manufacturing, including some so-called downwinders who suffered diseases including lung, thyroid, and pancreatic cancer. But despite its proximity to the test site, this area of western Arizona was never covered under the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. It left out population centers, including Las Vegas and some tribal lands.
For them to ignore Mojave County as not being touched by this radiation exposure is bizarre, and that's what we're trying to correct.
Last year, the U.S. Senate passed a bill that would have renewed and expanded compensation for downwinders, but House leadership never took up the bill, allowing it to expire in June. Now, Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley is trying to revive it.
It's a moral argument. It's about doing right by the people who love this country and in many cases gave their lives for this country, gave their health for this country.
Hawley's bill would include St. Louis, the site of a major Cold War era uranium processing plant. Generations there have also suffered from rare cancers and other diseases.
It's got big bipartisan support in the Senate. The House needs to act, and we need to get this done. Really, hundreds of thousands of Americans are depending on it.
The cost of the bill, however, could stretch into the tens of billions of dollars. Last week, one of Arizona's most conservative congressmen, Paul Gosar, introduced a less expensive version that would expand benefits only to Mojave County, Arizona, and Clark County, Nevada. Hawley and Gosar's bills have some advocates for radiation compensation optimistic. George Durrani, a Tucson-based attorney who's filed thousands of claims on behalf of downwinders, is watching House Speaker Mike Johnson closely.
I think it's going to come down to whether or not Speaker Johnson has the appetite for introducing a bill on the floor that will add to federal spending.
Speaker Johnson did not respond to requests for comment. Durrani says radiation exposure is an issue that ultimately cuts across ideologies and has impacted nearly every U.S. state.
It is a continuing, unfolding national tragedy. We bombed ourselves. We did this to our own people, and the consequences continue to play out every day.
At a moment of aggressive cost-cutting, a new Radiation Exposure Compensation Act's fate will hinge on support from the very congressional leaders who let the program lapse. For NPR News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. As President Trump pushes to end Russia's war in Ukraine, one of the key topics for negotiators will be sanctions. Since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine nearly 3 years ago, the United States and its allies have targeted the Russian economy. But has it worked? To understand Trump's leverage in this moment, we're going to turn now to Edward Fishman. He's a former U.S. sanctions official who's held roles at the Departments of State, Treasury, and Defense. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Choke Points, American Power in the Age of Economic Warfare. And he's with us now. Good morning, Mr. Fishman. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here with you today, Michelle.
So, you know, you hear two things about Russia. One, that they found workarounds for sanctions, and two, that their economy is in shambles. Which is it?
I think both are true. Russia certainly has weathered the initial storm of sanctions. I think if you go back to February of 2022, Russia felt like it was on the brink of collapse. You know, for a full month, its stock market shut down. You had massive bank runs when people were lining up on ATM lines. But then Russia's economy recovered. And part of that was that Russia found workarounds. But part also was that Russia was just taking advantage and weaknesses in the sanctions regime that the Biden administration and other Western leaders had put in place. The key absence from the initial sanctions regime was that the West was very hesitant, Michelle, to go after Russia's oil sales. Because if you think about the context, in early 2022, inflation in the United States was at a four-decade high, oil prices were skyrocketing, and President Biden was just very cautious, frankly. So Russia kept exporting oil and gas to its heart's content for the first year or so of the war. And in 2022, Russia actually raked in the highest energy revenues the Kremlin has ever collected.
So President Biden added more sanctions just before he left office. Like, what was that about and what was the thinking then?
In his last 10 days in the White House, Biden reversed that policy. He imposed blocking sanctions on two of the four largest oil companies in Russia. He also imposed sanctions on over 180 tankers that are shipping Russian oil. I think Biden felt comfortable doing this for two reasons. One is inflation is under control. Oil markets look well supplied. There's no longer skyrocketing oil prices. I think he was handing Trump a little bit more leverage that he could potentially use at the negotiating table. And of course, today, Russia's economy is sort of inexorably declining, and I think Putin is very desperate for sanctions relief right now.
So now that President Trump is talking about making a major push to end the war, what does he need to do on the economic side of things?
So Putin right now thinks that he can get Trump to lift sanctions without giving up anything of value. And I think that's what we saw in the meeting in Saudi Arabia, where Russia's strategy right now is basically to persuade Trump that sanctions relief is in America's interest. They want to basically treat Ukraine as a side issue and try to get sanctions relief before negotiations. So I think the most powerful thing Trump could do would be to signal very clearly that that is not going to happen, that Russia is not going to get any sanctions relief until it agrees to a just peace in Ukraine.
You know, the Biden administration espoused a rules-based international order and a human rights-based international order, okay? As we've seen, President Trump doesn't buy into a lot of that, so far as we can tell. His worldview is that what's in America's economic interest. So what steps might he be willing to take that are in alignment with his worldview?
Right. I do think that stronger sanctions are very much in very narrow American economic interests. Trump has called for American energy dominance. He can build upon this final sanctions package that Biden put together, impose more sanctions on Russian oil. If Russian companies are selling less oil and gas, that could create room for shale producers in the U.S. to export more of their product on global markets.
So before we let you go, as we mentioned, you have a forthcoming book called Choke Points, American Power in the Age of Economic Warfare. Can you take a step back and just tell us what you've learned about how America wields this economic warfare, as you put it?
So I think my biggest finding, Michelle, is that we are living in an age of economic warfare. Sanctions, tariffs, export controls, they've become the most prominent way that great powers compete with each other. Well, a data point that I find pretty enlightening is that Barack Obama imposed twice as many sanctions during his time in the White House as George W. Bush did. And then Trump imposed twice as many sanctions that Obama did. And then Biden doubled the number of sanctions that Trump imposed. I think the big difference with Trump is that he's wielding these tools not just against adversaries like China and Russia, but against our friends. I think that is probably the biggest change and the thing that could lead to the most significant ripple effects through the global order in the years to come.
That is Edward Fishman. He is a senior research scholar at Columbia University and the author of the forthcoming Choke Points, American Power in the Age of Economic Warfare. Edward Fishman, thanks so much for talking with us.
It was great to be here with you today.
This week is a big anniversary for an American cultural institution.
I assume you mean Saturday Night Live.
Well, they had a 50th anniversary special, but the New Yorker magazine doubled that. They are 100, having started in 1925. They've got a lot of continuity editors and writers who've served for decades, including Francois Molly, who's been the art editor for 32 years. And so we called up and asked, why does the New Yorker have such distinctive covers?
Because it was started in the era where magazine was a prime visual medium, and the cover has been, for all of this time, a drawing done by an artist and signed by the artist.
So real art.
Yes, handmade oil paintings, watercolors, magic markers, cut paper.
Most magazine covers tend to be a celebrity, a photo of a celebrity on the cover, and a lot of, like, cover lines that explains to you what is inside and why you should pick up that magazine. The New Yorker has none of that.
They just try to bring out a feeling.
Ideally make you laugh or touches you emotionally, gives you a sense of what's going on in the world, but not through words.
I mean, that's what I really wait for. I wait for the cover to see what the commentary is. I'm sure they did something really special for the 100th anniversary.
Well, you can wait for six covers. Molly says they riff on the iconic New Yorker mascot.
It's a dandy looking with his monocle at a mere butterfly.
The dandy, a little well-dressed, featured on the cover of the first issue one century ago.
The dandy has a starch collar, and he has an upturned nose, and he's wearing a top hat, and he is training his monocle on just a little fluttering butterflies.
So what does the dandy mean?
An image of sophistication and making fun of itself at the same time. And that's something that we try to do every week, to not take ourselves too seriously while still looking and scrutinizing the world with a distinctive monocle.
We too scrutinize, but without the monocle. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.